This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Yeah, and this is terrifying as a parent. Watch your 9-year-old pitch. I mean, it is hard to get that ball over the plate.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming our special guest for the week, the Kevin Durant of Education Policy, Chris Minnick.
Mike, does that make any sense? I'm a short, non-basketball playing white guy.
Yeah, but Kevin Durant, he's known as like, he's not as flashy as some of the other people. He doesn't talk a lot of smack, but he delivers. He delivers, all just right, like,
well,
you, Chris.
I'm excited to be in that category.
Boom, so, boom. Yeah. Chris, besides being a white, non-basketball playing short guy, yeah, Chris is also the executive director of the Council of Chief State School Officers. I never think of you as short, Chris, maybe because...
Well, I'm shorter than Durant.
Well, yeah. I mean, okay. So is like most of the world.
But, yeah. Well, yeah.
Chris, thanks so much for coming. And also joining us is Alyssa Schwenk.
Hey, Mike, does that make me Steph Curry?
Would you like to be Steph Curry?
I mean, I like Ayesha Curry better, but I'll take Steph Curry.
All right, there you go. Boom. Yeah. Boom. Yes. Alyssa, making the hard shots look easy. Alyssa Schwenk.
Oh. Boom. I like
but
it.
You did play basketball, right?
No, and as a tall person, I'm offended that you assumed that.
That's what we've talked about. You were offended when people assume that you play basketball. Volleyball? Nothing? Nothing? God gave you this gift of tallness, and you have not used it at
all? I have a 6'1 wingspan, so I use that to swim. But you've seen me like walk drop
swimming,
cups.
Swimming.
Like, hand-eye coordination, not a family trait.
The summer swim season is underway. We're pretty excited. Time trials on Saturday for the Trilly Boys. We'll see.
Boy, Carissa told me before I came over here that she's in swim practice with you.
That's right.
With your family.
That's right. Absolutely. See, it's a little weird when you see people that you know professionally, at the pool and everybody's in their bathing suits. That's just, one of those things that happens in the small world, the swampy world of Washington.
Actually gave my seat at the Banneker pool to someone at Bellwether this weekend. So
your seat at the
Banneker? I was at Banneker. Oh, we got there early. I had a seat. We were leaving. We gave it to a coworker, colleague.
Boom. There you go. All right, but we're not here to talk about that stuff. We're here to talk education reform. So it's now time for Ed Reform Update. All right, Chris, as everybody knows, 16 states plus the District of Columbia have submitted their plans for ESSA. Those of us in the education policy world, because we have nothing better to do, we are all reading them and commenting on them and giving you all a hard time about what we don't like about them, etc. I'll give you a little hint, though. We are looking at them at Fordham, and there's quite a few we actually do like.
Well, that's good news.
Well, we like to be contrarian, so that's going to be our angle. They're good, at least some of them.
They're better. They're better.
But what do you think? Do you have a favorite?
Yeah. So, well, since
we have a favorite child,
Right. We represent all 50 states. I don't think I'll tell you which one.
Oh, come on.
But I will tell you what I'm most excited about is how seriously states have taken this process. Mm-hmm. They are using new measures. I mean, so in high schools, you're seeing career readiness become a big part of what we're talking about. The goal setting process, and actually, I'd be interested in getting into this with you, but the setting of goals that are reasonable but challenging at the same time and trying to figure out how we don't just set a utopian goal for the country and not be able to achieve it. That would be this.
All of our kids are going to be college and career ready within 7 years.
That's right. And so you see states using dates like 2020, 2025, setting their big goals, but then having interim metrics to make sure they're on the right track.
By the way, can I say, I think the whole goal thing is really stupid.
Why?
Because it is. Because, well, my worry is that it does create this incentive for states to set utopian goals. Because if they don't, then groups like Education Trust and, Liz King, and these other people say, you're not, don't have high enough goals.
Well, but
the other problem, though, is look, it's one thing if the goal is, hey, here's our goal for how many kids we want to get to X point by the time they're 18 years old, and what that looks like year by year. The challenge with No Child Behind was always, we said, 100% of kids, proficient by 2014. And the 100% was a problem. But so was the fact that by 2014, you were still going to have kids coming into school way behind. And so were they supposed to be 100% proficient by the third grade by 2014?
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, that doesn't really make sense, just logically. I mean, so maybe if you say, all right, you're going to have the kid for all 12 years, and how many of those kids can you get to a high standard at the end of 12 years makes sense. But I don't think it makes sense to set targets for where do we want all third graders to be in 2030.
Yeah.
Because, unless something changes in our writ large in our country and economy, you're still going to have kids coming into kindergarten way behind, and it takes time to catch them up.
Right, but shouldn't we have a goal of every student being able to go on to something after they leave high school?
Yeah,
so there should be other ways.
At the end of high school, those goals I feel a little bit better about.
Okay.
All right, you don't want to name one of your favorites. Let me ask you this. Are there some elements on the accountability side that you are particularly excited about? You've said this about, setting stretch goals, but also not utopian goals. What else?
I mean, another thing that I think is pretty consistent across the plans is that they're still using student achievement as the primary indicator in almost every case, mainly because we don't have very many other metrics to go off of. But you are seeing states remain committed to student achievement. So I think that's a big deal.
And with the exception, Maryland submits its plan, I mean, it'll be an outlier, right?
It will be
65% based on student achievement.
That's a little lower than most states. So I do think keeping how kids are doing as the front of these conversations.
Yeah.
And then the last thing that we've seen pretty consistently across the states is a commitment to doing something different on the intervention side. So that we're not just sort of saying, here are the schools in the bottom 5%. But we're saying, here are the schools in the bottom 5%, here's what we're going to do about it. I think you guys would advocate for more charter replication and things like that. We think that's an option for states. But whatever they do, they've got to be serious about helping their districts improve their schools. Yeah. Because if we don't change what's going on in the low-performing area, all this is sort of for naught. And right. also on the high end. But
let's talk about this piece. Yeah. Have you been reading Rick Hess's blog post on this?
I have.
And his point that it a lot of this sounds like the old, what were they called, TPS reports from Office?
That's right.
That there's all these pretty words and these plans go on for hundreds of pages. And look, we've looked at some of this language around school improvement, and it is like, we're going to do needs assessments and we're going to, it's all the right jargon, but it doesn't sound, I don't know, maybe I'm missing it, but it doesn't sound all that bold to me. What am I missing? Why is Rick wrong to not just say that this is kind of some BS exercise that we're making states go through that's meaningless? Where's the beef?
Yeah. I mean, my sense is that that's the kind of challenging that states should welcome. Because if they are just writing down their plans, that's not going to help anything.
Just going through the motions.
Yeah, then they're just going through the motions. So I think we should be having this conversation in a year or so and see which states are really on the pathway to doing something different on improvement. Mm-hmm. Look, we've seen state takeover has had mixed results.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The ASD in Tennessee has had some good results, I think.
The I-Zone in Tennessee.
I-Zone has had quite good. Yeah, and so... So I guess I just hope that we stay rooted in the fact that we're looking for evidence as we go through this process, that it's not just our favorite thing that we choose, whether it be state takeover or something else, but that the states are actually reflecting on what they're seeing. I'll just point out Massachusetts, they've done most of us have heard the Lawrence story, but that community really feels like they own their turnaround.
Yeah.
And I think there's something to be said for trying to figure out how do you, a needs assessment is a needs assessment, but what if the community is doing the needs assessment, that may be different than the state doing the needs assessment.
Yeah. What's the state to keep an eye on from your perspective? Like who's doing something interesting? Who's doing something new under their ESSA plan?
So one thing that's front of mind for me is DC's plan. So thinking about having the charters and the public schools under the same accountability system, I think is a huge deal. And for the first time, we'll be judging charter schools in DC and public schools around the same metrics. And I think that'll be a big deal for us looking for evidence about how schools are doing. So that's one thing. I would also say there's a number of states that have really gotten serious about credentials around career readiness and credentials of value. So states have, I would say, haven't done as good a job at high school of making sure the credentials result in employable outcomes for kids. And I think some states are taking a step towards that right now.
Very cool.
And Alyssa, what's your take on groups like Fordham, but others, I see NCTQ is doing something, Bellwether. I mean, all the think tanks and advocacy groups are going to read these plans and write reports about them. I mean, is this still worth doing? Is
accountability worth doing?
No, more of a process point. Is this the kind of thing of where we make states write down their plans and then we shoot at them for not writing plans we like? I mean, is this going to matter in the real world? Is it going to move the needle on anything?
I mean, I think what matters is how we're communicating this to parents and teachers and communities and what we're telling them that their state believes about accountability and helping them to understand what's in the plan that's new. I think we were all at EWA last week, and several of the sessions were about, like, how do we, you know, talk to parents about, like, what's different between the No Child Left Behind era and the ESSA era. And I think we, as the wonkity wonk podcasting community, need to get better at explaining what the difference is to a parent who's in a suburb whose school is doing okay about what this meaningfully means to their instruction in school.
Chris, do the states care what groups in D.C. say about their plans?
Please don't tell
even
us
if there's some negative press for a day or two, do they care?
Well, you know, Mike, I'm here, so we care.
Thank you, Chris. Yeah, thank you.
I think
that, good answer. Yeah, would you like to come back?
That's right. Thank you for having me. But I just think the bigger thing is states actually need support in getting these things right. Mm-hmm. Like, what would maybe be better is if we stopped reviewing plans and actually went into the states and helped them get their plans right.
Yeah.
So I hope whatever reviews take place result in states reflecting rather than being on the defensive.
Yeah.
Because if states are on the defensive, they're not going to change anything.
Hey, let me tell you, we would love to be helpful here at Fordham. And if you want to have states that are applying in September, they're sending in their plans, send us drafts or ask us questions. We would love to tell them exactly what to do.
Yeah, I mean,
because we're those kind of people. We're the man that Rick Hess talks about.
Well, and I think we do run the risk of sort of having the solution on high, you know, from D.C. or from anywhere, sort of telling any state what's going on in their local community when they've done a bunch of stakeholder engagement. I'm not sure is the best way.
No, and I don't believe there's one right way to go. I also suspect there's not 50 right ways to go. You know, and there's probably more like, hey, there's a handful of ways to go in any of these issues that are legitimate because it's about trade-offs and about, you know, and it would be great if we can have some variation and then track it, see what happens. I mean, for, you know, at Fordham, we've been very worried about high-achieving, low-income kids and the fact that under NCLB, they were not a priority. So, you know, we have some hypotheses on how states can signal to schools that those kids matter, but we're going to find out. I mean, it'll be interesting to see if states, for example, that go big on growth for all kids, do we see achievement go up for those high-end kids over time? More so than in other states. So that we can answer empirically eventually.
What do you think the civil rights community needs to see for that to change? Like, that's a real issue for me. Like, I want to make sure that we aren't leaving kids out of these metrics.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's a huge deal.
Yeah.
But this conversation about super subgroups, even when we're including more kids, that's often not enough.
Yeah, look, I think that's still right. We should look at it empirically. And and again, the variation allows us to do that and say, you know, are they right that if you have super subgroups, then you see achievement for, you know, African-American kids or Latino kids decline or not?
Right.
We should be able to answer that empirically. It's tricky, you know, when you try to compare states to one another, you know, we're not randomly assigning these different plans to a state. Though, by the way, that would be awesome if we could do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can I take just like Massachusetts plan and randomly assign it to, I don't know, like South
Ohio?
Dakota?
Yeah.
I mean, from a research perspective, that would be ideal. Yeah. Can you work on that?
Yeah. We'll get right up. State rights, Mike.
Yeah.
Local control.
Whatevs. All right. That is all the time we've got. Thanks so much for coming on, Chris.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
All right. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
You know, Alyssa reminded me yet again that she did not play basketball nor volleyball.
I hand-eye coordination sports.
But she did swim.
Yes.
I forget, did you play sports?
I was softball. My dad was my softball coach ever since I was like a kid.
Nice.
I played in high school. So, and I played intramurals in college. I was first baseman.
That's important.
It's important, right? I wasn't that great of a hitter, but I was a good catcher.
So
softball terrifies me.
Are you ready for this? Nico last night pitched an inning.
Really?
You want to see something? I mean, this is terrifying as a parent. Watch your 9-year-old pitch. I mean, it is hard to get that ball over the plate.
Is it soft, like underhand or overhand?
No, baseball.
It is. Yes. Oh, the real deal.
The real deal. 46 feet away. He's got a pitch and he got 2 strikeouts and no runs. Yes.
Is he right or left-handed?
Right.
Strange question. Okay, because as a left-handed person who played softball for 3 or 4 years when I was growing up, I got beamed so many times and that was the terrifying part for my parents. Yeah.
But he's getting all the limelight as the pitcher. That's like the big thing.
I was so proud. It's hard. He had done it a few other times, had not gone as well. And so this is
you got to have nerves of steel for that pitching position.
Oh my God. Yeah. I can't do it. I could not do it.
Were you able to watch it?
It was hard.
Okay.
Yes. He did great. All right. So what you got for us?
All right. We're talking about super subgroups today. Woohoo. Fun, fun. Nearly 40 states, recall, got waivers under the Obama administration to get around NCLBs. Remember this 2014, everybody's going to be proficient thing. So we remember the waivers. So studies are just starting to come out now that examine the impacts of some of these provisions of the waivers.
We just talked about this with Chris Menon, on super subgroups. And I said it would be great to have empirical evidence about whether or not if you move to super subgroups, do the individual subgroup do worse or not?
You're like magic.
And there you are. Ask if we shall receive.
All right. Well, here you go. We have one such study from the state of Kentucky.
Oh, my gosh.
All right. So under the waivers, recall that the feds required that states identify schools where subgroups of students have the lowest achievement and to implement research-based interventions in these schools, which were being called focus schools. You guys remember this?
Yep.
That's what you got to call them. Stanford's Tom D.
Boom.
And colleagues study the impact, and colleagues, I feel bad when I say that. Tom D's the main one I knew. Study the impact of focus school reform efforts in the bluegrass state. Now, remember, Kentucky's kind of interesting because do you guys remember why Kentucky's interesting?
Horses?
They
were one of the earliest adopters of the Common Core.
First adopters.
It wasn't even finished
yet. They adopted it before it was finished.
Yes, I got it.
You did.
Which was not something I ever thought was a great idea.
That's a little strange. All right, anyway, they won $17 million in the federal Race to the Top competition. They got a bunch of money.
Yep.
And they were among the first group of states to apply for the waiver.
Yep.
All right, so they also developed explicit guidance for their focus schools. More on that in a minute. And they used a super subgroup measure that it combined all traditional low-performing subgroups. So you had the free and reduced lunch kids that were eligible for that, the special education kids, Black, Hispanic, American Indian, and limited English proficient students all in the same group, okay? An umbrella group. They called it the student gap group. Mm-hmm. In Kentucky, just a little bit more on background, all schools, so you kind of get the idea between the treatment and the control. So all schools actually had to have the school improvement plan in Kentucky. They had a school committee. I don't know how this works, but parents, students, community members, can you hear Rick talking about this on paper? Anyway, we're in charge of looking after the plan, right? And figuring out whether it was on track. The focus schools, however, had to have the school improvement plan and do a bunch of other stuff. So they had to make sure that the curriculum was aligned to Common Core. They had to have time for teacher collaboration. They had to have data-driven strategies. They had to make sure that they were improving school discipline and safety and a bunch of other stuff, okay? Analysts used school report card data for over 900 elementary and middle schools and school-level measures of student proficiency. And they use a bunch of school-level data on schools, teachers, and students. They focus on, all right, this is a drawback, the first full year of implementation. So 1 year, 2013-14, because after that year, guess what?
New standards?
Nope. All the schools are doing what the focus schools were doing. So they lost their treatment control group. So they can only look at 1 year. All right. Findings. A fifth of the analytic sample, about 187 schools, were focus schools. Okay. The student gap score was based on 2011-2012, so the year before. That was the main criteria that determined whether you were eligible for being a focus school. So they used this regression discontinuity design where they compare the gap schools in school, the gap groups in schools just above and below the cutoff. Okay. We see a lot of these designs these days. Key finding, substantial improvements in school performance. Specifically, the focus schools see math achievement rise by 5 percentage points, which is equivalent to a 17% increase for the targeted students compared to the comparison group mean. Reading achievement increased by about 9%, so not quite as much. They find positive but not always statistically significant results for the non-gap, so the rest of the kids, okay, as well. Other states, by the way, this NBR has got a whole bunch, like a series of papers on the waiver evaluations. So I think Tom D did Louisiana as well and didn't find much at all. And so they're hypothesizing, okay, what is it? And they think that having this large umbrella group of underserved kids, a super subgroup, helped to foster improvement more widely as opposed to having this narrowly targeted subgroup of just one group of kids. But importantly, in the analysis, they make sure that having this super subgroup doesn't mask low individual subgroup performance of some smaller group. So, I mean, I think that's
Know if the individual subgroup did better? Were they able to look at that? Did African-American kids in their schools do better?
Yeah, they did not look at that in this particular study. But they did a bunch of robust tests to make sure that, because that's the big thing everybody worries about, right? That the super subgroup is now masking, you know, some other little miniature subgroup.
Well, right. And that either they, you know, so you'll have a school that gets better for some kids but not for others, or that there's just schools that don't get an intervention because they're, say, a mixed income school, and the wealthy kids are doing fine. The poor kids are not doing fine.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that just doesn't pop up on the radar screen. I guess this doesn't explicitly answer that one.
That's right.
Per
That's
se.
Right. Yeah. But I mean, I think the takeaway here is that, you know, when they looked at whether it was helpful for all kids, you know, there were some slight positive results there too. But definitely wasn't harming those other kids.
No, I'm just impressed that any of these interventions actually seem to work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Not all of them, like I said, but Kentucky. I guess some other states, you know, they all take their own approaches to this. But yeah, I mean, I think it's great news for Kentucky, right? Because like I said, they were kind of coming out there really aggressively against for Common Core and some of these other things.
So right.
They had a little bit of a running start in terms of thinking about some of these accountability issues too.
So what are the takeaways for states as they look towards for those who have not submitted an ESSA plan, like what can they learn from this?
Yeah, I mean, I think, right, for all the attention super subgroups got, you know, and all the confusion, I mean, I think this is pretty promising, right, in terms of, you know, you can think about this issue more encompassing and not just sort of target those interventions on the smallest group of bubble kids.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, you can kind of think of it more broadly.
And once you identify the schools to have an intervention, I mean, when states have to say, what are you going to do to improve the lowest performing schools, including with your Title I set aside? Is there stuff in here that's going to help them have
good
ideas?
I mean, I think the part that is both, you know, a bummer for researchers is when, you know, they expand the interventions to every school. And that kind of makes you wonder, like, how robust an intervention could it have been to be able to say, okay, next year everybody's got
to
do this.
And if the state has the capacity to pull that
to
off.
To handle that, right. So that kind of was a little suspicious. But then when you look at what they had to do that was extra, like make sure your curriculum is aligned to Common Core, like, hello, shouldn't everybody be doing that?
Low left.
Yeah. And collaboration with teachers. And so on the one hand, you think, well, it had to be somewhat robust because we saw these bumps. But on the other hand, you think, well, it couldn't be that hard if they could just wave a wand.
They're always in this question. If you just know you're on the watch list or whatever, and you're kind of being, you know, that alone can have give you at least a small bump one time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Because we're not, we don't have a 3-year trend line here.
Yeah. Yet, so get your act together kind of signal.
Yeah. And we see this in a lot of accountability studies, right? Where you see that big jump, you know, that next year after they've been identified. So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, very good. Well, hey, love it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
MBER, Policy Relevant, Tom D. This has got it all. That is all the time we've got for this week. Until next week.
I'm Alyssa Schwenk.
And I'm Mike Petrilli, Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.